Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest has been bridging the cultural divide between Americans and Afghans as a wartime translator and cultural advisor to the military. She was one of a handful of female Pashto speakers when she first returned to her native Afghanistan in 2004 after leaving as a refugee when she was six. Saeem Al-Wahab's new memoir, In My Father's Country, An Afghan Woman Defies Her Fate, is a rich look at Pashtun culture and the challenges that Americans still face in Afghanistan. Saeem Al-Wahab, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you. Where are you today?
I am actually in D.C. today.
Why did you go back to Afghanistan, a country you left as a refugee, with great difficulty? You write about your father's disappearance at the hands of the KGB when you were three, and about your disgust with the way that Pashtun people treat women. Some in your family saw Americans as an invading force in this country as well. So why did you go back?
I think there was two kinds of missions going on. There was a personal one in which I wanted to see what it was about my people that made me who I am, because you always wonder why you do certain things. And I have habits that I just can't get rid of because that's the Afghan in me. But then there's also the professional side of it, because I felt obligated that I have the knowledge and the language and the background to help the U.S. Army and the U.S. soldiers and help them understand a culture which is so alien to them. They don't understand the language. They don't understand the traditions. They don't understand the people. They only see half of the people, which are just the men. And we're sending them to a country like that to fight for hearts and minds of people. It was very hard to do. And so I feel obligated to continue to go back and try to help them understand Afghanistan and Afghan people while I'm trying to understand it myself.
You're literally a translator, and this book is mostly about this great divide between American culture and Pashtun culture, your family's culture. At one point, even though you're wearing a headscarf, a mullah tells you that you will go to hell for what you're doing, and you thank him. Why?
Because you are in a culture where you don't disrespect your elders, you don't disrespect anyone who is associated with Islam. It would have caused more harm and negative image for the army, because I was representing the army at that meeting. I was representing the Americans in that meeting, and I didn't want to insult anyone. And sometimes it's also easier to just take criticism, and as long as you know in your heart that you're not going to go to hell, I think it's okay if somebody tells you for what you believe in, because there are always people who are not going to see things the way you see them.
Somebody once told you that in the military, perception is reality. You note that in Pashtun culture, that's true as well. How did you bring that to your work?
My work actually was a lot easier because, believe it or not, army culture is very similar to Pashtun culture. There's so many similarities. I would be sitting in a meeting, something would happen, and I would feel like, wait, is this Afghan meeting or is this army meeting? Because it would be so typical of Pashtun behavior, certain things. You know, I get into it more in the book, but I actually was able to understand perceptions and try to address the negative sides of it, or try to change perceptions by understanding it, and that made it easier for me to have discussions, informed discussions with Afghan villagers, at the same time with soldiers who were 18, 19 years old, who didn't know Afghanistan, who didn't know anything, and I would be sitting in the chow hall with them discussing perceptions with them. So it made it easier for me to understand where they were coming from.
Many of the translators that you describe in the book don't actually speak Pashto. They lie about speaking the language so they can keep their jobs, because they really speak Farsi. And this goes on for years. You discovered it when you first arrived, and it was still the case when you left again in 2009. So how is it possible that that kind of oversight and deception can go on for so long?
I think we we go into Afghanistan, or we went to Afghanistan thinking as Americans. And in America, everyone speaks English. You know, maybe you have a funny accent from New York or from Oregon like I do. And so we don't really understand that there are completely different languages with completely different politics. And so Americans didn't even realize when they were hearing something, they didn't know if it was Pashto or Farsi, and the interpreters weren't really being truthful. And because of that, and they also, I don't think they understand the language politics in Afghanistan, and that's why they thought, well, that's okay. If they don't speak Pashto, they obviously can speak Farsi, so we're just going to speak Farsi with them. And because of these things, it took a while. I think now the army is realizing that it is important to take a Pashtun interpreter to Pashtun village. Now they're realizing it, but unfortunately, it has caused a lot of negative feelings between the Afghans and the Americans, which were not necessary, I believe.
It took 10 years for them to realize this.
Yes. One of the things that Army is famous for is doing things a little slower. They like to figure things out slow. But, you know, I'm just happy that they are doing it now. I'm just happy for that.
And what harm do you think that lack of translation has caused?
Well, when you think about it, you're going into to fight an insurgency that is local, that is native. Even if it's coming from Pakistan, they speak the language, and then you send in a company commander or a PRT commander who doesn't understand any of it, who has to use someone else's linguistic skills. It is very important to have the right tools to go in there. It's one thing to have weapons and tanks and Humvees and all those things, but I think more important than all of those is having the right person represent your words and your tone and your language to them. So I would think that things could have been prevented if we had realized going in that it was important to have the right interpreters.
My guest on WNYC is Saima Wahab. She's been a translator between Afghans and the U.S. military during the Afghanistan war, and she has now written the book, In My Father's Country, An Afghan Woman Defies Her Fate. What was your fate?
My fate was a life of no education. Probably at this point by now I should have had 25 children, I believe. Maybe a husband who didn't beat me up. Maybe he just ignored me, and I would think that I was very lucky that he didn't beat me up. And basically cut off from the rest of the world, not knowing anything. And if I were a typical Pashtun woman in Afghanistan today, I would worry about my children going outside and not coming back alive, because I would think they might be victims of a bomb on the roadside, or somebody might just kidnap them. So I think that was the fate that I was supposed to have.
And in defying your fate, you were a rarity as a female Pashto English speaker. And even so, you had trouble getting to speak with women who are rarely in public, you write. Do you think that much has changed in the past decade for Pashto women post-Taliban rule?
I really don't think so. The country is divided into two separate areas. You have the bigger cities, you know, which are just a handful. Kabul is one of them. And then you have the rest of the country, 95% of the country, which are all in the villages. In the villages, nothing has changed for women. They still are not able to come outside the house without some men accompanying them. Even if it's somebody who's 8 years old, that works too. They also are not working. They're not going to school. They're worried for their safety. They don't have any opinions. They don't understand anything as far as, you know, what is going on in the country. They're so cut off. So for me, I almost feel a little upset for the Pashtun woman in the villages, because everybody is thinking, you know, things have improved. Yes, they have improved in Kabul. You see girls wearing jeans, and that's great. But what about the other 95% of the population that lives outside Kabul? You have those people, and those were the focus of my work. I always went into the villages because I know what is going on in Kabul. It's not important to me. It was more important to me to connect with village women. And you are right. I didn't get to connect with them a lot because I wasn't allowed to go in with my soldiers, male soldiers. And there are not that many female soldiers in the army that would be going in there with me. And so I couldn't go for my own safety. I was only able to have just maybe 5-6 chances where I went into and talked to women.
What do you think is the best route to change in the villages, and would it be helped or hindered by the U.S. withdrawal scheduled for 2014?
I believe the best way to change the lives of women in Afghanistan are to make the lives of men better. If the men are satisfied with their lives, they are able to provide for their families, they have security, they have jobs, they don't feel threatened by their women, then you can address the issues of their women. I really don't think we have, we don't even have access to the Pashtun woman, to the Afghan woman, without their men. We can't do anything to upset the men to help the woman. We actually have to make them partners. And this is something that I always told my army commanders. You can't open a sewing store or shop or internet cafe for women and expect women to come there when the men are not allowing them to come outside. It just doesn't work. For that reason, I think you need to involve the men in it, but then now we're leaving. And as you know, the security is not going to improve at all in the villages. People are just going to come out, and I mean insurgents, they're just going to come out and take over little villages and basically rule the way things were before the first Taliban in the 1990s.
Would you rather the U.S. stayed and doubled down and fought village to village?
It's not that simple at this point, and I know probably a little more than the average American knows because I spent so much time there. I do know the need to come back here. I wish I had a solution that I could discuss in just a few minutes, but for me, I think it's more important to show support and friendship to everyone and not just focus on the government in Kabul right now, because I don't think that government is going to be around for that much longer without us.
There are moments in the book where you note that something was possible in 2005 or 2006, but not any longer, you seem to say. Stopping a convoy, for example, to talk to a woman who was running after you, waving her arms, begging for medical care for her daughter, or going to a bazaar to shop, or any other opportunities for more casual and frequent contact between Afghans and U.S. soldiers to build hearts and minds. If these opportunities are more dangerous than they were 6 or 7 years ago, then where does this leave the U.S. effort in Afghanistan? It seems from your book that things are actually worse now than ever.
Unfortunately, they are worse than ever. And when I first went into Afghanistan, people would come out and they will say hello to us and they would scream, "I love you, I love you." It was really cute because you will have these little kids running alongside your Humvees. Of course, that completely changed by 2009, middle of 2009 when I was leaving. We would be lucky if we went into a village and one person showed up because people were intimidated. They were either intimidated or they just didn't like what we were doing in the country, whether it was burning the Quran or, you know, going in, doing night raids or whatever it was, they were upset with us. And it is very much apparent, anyone who has gone to Afghanistan as a soldier, been deployed in the beginning, and they go now, they'll tell you the same thing. Things have changed a lot, and unfortunately not for the better. They've changed for the worse.
So as a translator and a cultural advisor to the U.S. military, how do you keep from being totally disillusioned by these dangerous cultural misunderstandings, even the Quran burning that you mentioned?
I have many wonderful examples and experiences of soldiers in Afghanistan, in theater, where they were so caring and they were so sensitive to the Afghan culture and the Afghans around them that remembering those stories, remembering how soldiers helped and reached out, like in the book I talk about only one of them, but there were so many other times when I would see a soldier show kindness to an Afghan old man or a kid, and that would just touch me. And any time I felt like giving up and I felt like, you know, this is not going to go anywhere, I would just remember those soldiers. I would remember what they did, and I would remember them coming back and almost crying with what they saw in the villages and how they wanted to do better. And of course, then I ran into soldiers who are volunteering to go back to Afghanistan on their third tours. And those are the kind of things that continued, didn't let me stop and give up.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. My guest has been Saima Wahab. her new memoir about her upbringing as a Pashtun woman in the United States, and then about her work in Afghanistan as a translator, is called In My Father's Country, An Afghan Woman Defies Her Fate. Thank you so much for talking about this with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, a call-in for New Jerseyans. How do you want to say goodbye to the Nets? Will it be different from the way Chris Christie did? His usual blunt fashion. We'll play the clip. Stay with us.